Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Sam, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and the Lymphoma Research Foundation. And it really, and we've also collaborated with a number of other organizations as well. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 542 participants. You come from all of the United States, all different parts of the country. And we have international participants from Canada, Kenya, Korea, Norway, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's a credit to each of you that you're choosing to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program, this teleconference, is supported by unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Gilead Sciences and Teva Oncology. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. Now, you have received a number of materials from Cancer Care, and in those materials there is an evaluation form. I want to ask you all to take a moment and complete that evaluation form at the end of the program today. When you think about it, who but each of you can really best tell us what topics and programs we should be offering. Indeed, today's topic is one that many have asked us to offer, and we've put this together. I also want to acknowledge the Lymphoma Research Foundation in taking a significant role as the archetype of really setting up today's program. They've really worked with us to really help to make this program what it is today in terms of the speakers and the topics, and really also outreaching to all of you. So I want to really thank them for that, all of their work on this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan O'Brien. And Dr. O'Brien is Professor of Medicine, Department of Leukemia, University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. O'Brien is going to address an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, tips to manage complications and side effects, and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Brien.
Hi. Good afternoon, all. I'm going to start off the program today and talk a bit overview of CLL, and then I think Dr. Kipps is going to really talk about the treatment approach. Some of you might be thinking, well, what does CLL and lymphoma have to do with one another? And this is a question we often get asked, particularly if patients read their PATH reports and it says small lymphocytic lymphoma, and then they sometimes even get worried that they have two diagnoses. Small lymphocytic lymphoma is really the cells that the pathologist sees in a lymph node biopsy. There are patients who present only with lymph node involvement, and they don't have involvement of the bone marrow or the blood. They would be patients who we would then call small lymphocytic lymphoma, because if they don't have any issues with their blood, then by definition they don't have leukemia. The same exact cells in a bone marrow and then in the peripheral blood circulating define this now as leukemia, and so those are patients we call as having CLL. When a pathologist looks at a lymph node, he may not know whether the patient has bone marrow involvement or blood involvement. He can just describe what kind of lymphoma he sees in the lymph node. And so you might see that a lymph node biopsy says small lymphocytic lymphoma, but you might get told that your overall diagnosis is CLL. And so there's no reason to be concerned. It's really a continuum of the same disease. And again, some people just have lymphoma, and anybody who has bone marrow and blood involvement with an elevated lymphocyte count in the blood would then be called CLL. The staging is a little bit confusing, too, because peripheral blood involvement without any lymph node enlargement, for example, would be stage 0 CLL. So all the patient has is an elevated lymphocyte count. But if they have lymph nodes all over the body, that would then be a stage 1. However, according to lymphoma staging, the bone marrow involvement makes it a stage 4. So it's very confusing, understandably, because what sounds like very bad staging on lymphoma is actually called relatively good staging in leukemia. What I would advise you there is just go by the leukemia staging. That's the relevant one. So many patients have either stage 0 disease or stage 1 disease when they present. And again, 0 would be just an elevated lymphocyte count, no enlargement of the lymph nodes or the spleen, and the other blood counts are normal, such as the hemoglobin and the platelets, so they don't have anemia, for example. Well, stage 1 is blood involvement, but now lymph node involvement also. And again, those are the two most common stages at which people get diagnosed. When I say present, I mean present to a doctor and are diagnosed. Why is that? Well, because it's very frequent for people to get diagnosed by a routine physical, which in which the doctor may notice some enlarged lymph nodes, or sometimes even the patient does, particularly if they're in the neck. Somebody goes to scratch their neck and then feels a lymph node. Or they have a blood count done as part of their routine physical, and they're found to have CLL. Now, as many of you know, what makes CLL a little bit different than pretty much any other leukemia is that when we diagnose a patient with CLL, we don't necessarily start treatment. And there's a number of reasons for this. Many people have no symptoms, which is why the diagnosis is made accidentally, if you will. They feel fine. The lymph nodes that may be there are small and not bothering them. And elevated lymphocyte count is not usually something people will feel or notice. People can walk around with very high lymphocyte counts and feel totally fine. So many patients are not having any symptoms whatsoever. In addition, many people have very slow-moving disease so that they can go years and years with very little change in their disease or very modest change in the disease and still have no symptoms. The other point is that patients with CLL tend to be older, so the average age is around 70. And the truth is, people who are in their 70s often have a lot of other medical problems, high blood pressure, diabetes, coronary artery disease, et cetera. And in fact, if we take all patients who come in with early stage CLL, about a third of them will never need treatment for the CLL, and they'll die of other causes that older people die of, including heart disease and other cancers. So if the person has no symptoms at all and the disease is not bothering them, it's not going to impact their survival or their lifespan, then why bother to do anything about it? Now, people might say, well, but how do you think you can get rid of the disease if you don't treat it early? Well, there actually were a number of trials conducted back in the 80s that are called randomized trials, meaning one group of patients were allocated one way randomly, like a flip of a coin, and the others were allocated another way. And so these trials looked at immediate treatment with chlorambucil, even in people who had no symptoms, or people where this watch and wait strategy was employed. And what they showed is that the long-term survival, or how long patients lived, was the same. And so that led people to say, well, you know, why bother to give people chemo, which does have side effects, that doesn't affect their long-term survival? Now, some of you on the phone might be thinking, well, come on, Dr. O'Brien, don't you think there's better treatments than chlorambucil? And I do. But again, if a third of patients would never need treatment, why would you want to give them chemotherapy? Now, this is where some of the newer prognostic factors are coming in. You may have heard of some of these. So we look for chromosome abnormalities, such as an 11q deletion or a 17p, which generally suggests that the disease is going to progress sooner rather than later. Mutation status, things, proteins like ZAP70, et cetera, there are a whole number of them. And where they're useful is when we now have a patient who presents without much disease, we can kind of predict, is this somebody who may go their whole lives without treatment, or if not their whole life, maybe they're coming in a bit younger than the average age, may go 10 or 20 years, in which case the treatments will probably be totally different, Or is this somebody who maybe doesn't need treatment today because they don't have any symptoms? But actually, all of these tests suggest to me that in 2 or 3 years they will. Those are patients where now there are clinical trials going on to say, well, if we treat those higher-risk patients early, will we benefit them? Because those are patients where it's not a question of are they ever going to be treated. It's more a question of when. However, as of today, we don't have the results of those clinical trials yet. So we still don't have any clinical trials that clearly show, even in a higher-risk patient, that treating the disease earlier will benefit them. And until we have the results of those trials, we keep to our standard approach, which is not to intervene with chemotherapy in patients who have no symptoms and are doing fine and feel well. And the important thing to note is that most people who don't have any symptoms and are feeling fine have pretty normal lifestyles. Most of the side effects of chemotherapy can be dealt with pretty easily, but why bother if you're feeling fine and the disease is not bothering you? So to a large extent, the way you can all kind of look at it is, well, how do we decide when to treat CLL? Well, basically, we decide to treat, to put it really simply, when the disease is causing problems. So if the lymphocyte count is getting very high, if the lymph nodes are getting bulky, the spleen is getting large and bothering the patient, making them lose their appetite, if they're starting to get anemic, which would be associated with increased fatigue, et cetera. And sometimes the indications for treatment are different, and they may not be the same in every patient. So when we're deciding when to treat a patient, we have to look at a lot of things and put the picture all together, the physical exam, the blood counts, and the symptoms that the patient may be having. And as I said, in some people it may be more bulky nodes, and in other patients, for example, it might be that they're getting anemic. So the reasons for treatment can vary, and obviously, as we just discussed, the time to needing treatment can vary quite a bit also. What about when you have CLL and you're not getting treated? Are there things that you really have to be nervous about or be on the lookout for? Not necessarily, but what you do have to keep in mind is that even people who've never had to have any treatment don't have totally normal immune systems. Now, generally, the earlier you are in your diagnosis, particularly if you've never received chemotherapy, your immune system is pretty good. And most people don't have a lot of infections. But some people do, and sometimes those infections are harder to shake. And I think what's key here is that if you start to get sick, you want to let your doctor know. In other words, if you don't have leukemia and you start to get a cold, maybe even run a fever, which is a bit unusual in an adult, you may think, well, I probably have the flu and I feel terrible. Let me go to bed and take some Tylenol, drink some soup, and I'll be better in a few days. And that's a reasonable strategy because even today, we don't have very good treatments for the flu. It's the common cold, as many of you know. On the other hand, that strategy might not be such a great one in a leukemia patient because they may be getting something more serious, or they may be getting what would be a minor infection in someone without leukemia, but it becomes more serious or more difficult to shake in someone with leukemia. And so the key to that, I think, is really making sure that one of the times that when you definitely want to see your doctor or notify your doctor that there's a problem is if you're getting sick, particularly if you're running a fever. As I mentioned, it's not very common for adults to run fevers outside the setting of perhaps the flu. Most people with a common cold don't run a fever. So if you're getting a fever or some type of infection, it's very important to let your doctor know because he may or she may want to intervene early, be a little bit more aggressive with antibiotics than they would be with somebody who didn't have leukemia. I don't think there's anything you really have to do differently in that setting except to make sure that you have good communication with your healthcare team so that anything can be nipped in the bud and you don't wind up quite ill because you've sort of ignored these symptoms for a few days and now are really under the gun and quite sick. So I think that's important time to communicate with your healthcare team even if you're not getting any chemo, and generally you're feeling fine. I think I'll stop there maybe and let Dr. Kipps take over for a while.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Brien, for a very comprehensive overview, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Thomas Kipps. And Dr. Kipps is Evelyn and Edwin Tash Chair in Cancer Research, Professor of Medicine, UC San Diego Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Kipps is going to address new treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Kipps.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be on this teleconference. We live in a very exciting time with regard to the treatment for chronic lymphocytic leukemia patients, and I think the number of new trials and new agents that are out there almost are much more than we have really this short time to discuss. However, I think it's important to state that this is a great time because of the development of new tools to treat patients that are having effects through different mechanisms of actions. I can go through and cover some of the broad categories of them. One are the use of the nature of the biology of the disease. By understanding how the leukemia cell works, we've been able to identify important enzymes within the cells that are important for governing how these cells will home to the lymph nodes or survive once they are there. And there is a whole category of drugs which can inhibit certain enzymes that have a tremendous impact on that biology. There are a number of leading candidate drugs that are currently under clinical trials. One, of course, is the drug ibrutinib, which targets, among other enzymes, the Bruton's tyrosine kinase. But there are other drugs as well, such as the GS1101, formerly called CAL101, that targets another enzyme that's very important for how these cells receive signals from the outside environment. Another category, ALLA-292, is a drug that's developed along the lines of ibrutinib to inhibit similar enzymes. And even the drug sorafenib, which has been approved for the treatment of patients with kidney cancer, is found to have some activity in patients with CLL. And I think that there may be many more different drugs that may come down to inhibit enzymes that are very important for how these leukemic cells survive or traffic through the body. I think one of the manifestations of these drugs is, first, if they're a pill form, generally they have been well tolerated. The number of side effects are being analyzed in clinical trials, and they appear to be modest. The activity is quite striking because in many cases, one can find that very large lymph nodes may become smaller within a very short time. Oftentimes, there's an emptying of the cells within the lymph nodes into the bloodstream so that you might find the white cell count going up, actually. So it almost looks paradoxical from the standpoint of what these patients are going through. But generally speaking, the white cell count will peak and then subside over time. And either when you use the drug by itself or in combination with other drugs, you can actually bring down the white cell count and affect clinical responses using a whole new category of agents which are not like your former types of chemotherapy. I think the key aspect here is that we certainly are very excited about some of the ongoing clinical trials to use these agents either by themselves or in combination with monoclonal antibodies, and I think that the future for these drugs may be very interesting indeed. The aspect of another category of drugs which is being developed are ones that inhibit important proteins that really underpin the survival of leukemia cells. There's a protein called BCL2, which is at high levels in leukemia cells, and that's been noted for some years. And so by using the model of what this protein does, it's called BCL2, it inhibits the capacity of these leukemia cells to actually undergo cell death. And when you target this protein, the leukemia cells may actually undergo cell death either by themselves or when you add something like a monoclonal antibody that targets the leukemia cell. And the current drugs that are being developed, such as ABT-199, are quite specific for this protein. They bind to a specific spot on the protein and prevent it from having its function. And again, these are orally active so that patients can take them as a pill form. The early trials that were initiated were quite striking because the fact that they work through a different way, they can treat patients who oftentimes may be refractory to various forms of chemotherapy. In fact, the first patients treated with these drugs had a problem in that their tumors cell lysed so quickly that sometimes too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. So right now there's attempts to find the right dose so that we can avoid the problems associated with what's called tumor lysis, where the tumor cells lyse so quickly as to make it difficult to clear the byproducts of the cells from the kidneys. Now, I think the use of these agents, either alone or in combination with antibodies, is very attractive. We live in a different age because we are using monoclonal antibodies to treat patients with CLL. Monoclonal antibodies have been a game changer, particularly the drug such as rituximab, and patients are living longer with therapy than they were living in the past with therapy. It's really because of the specificity of these monoclonal antibodies. These are proteins that we have in the blood. We oftentimes, when we get an infection, we can generate antibodies against a bacteria, and this helps us fight the infection. Well, through the use of monoclonal antibodies, we can have antibodies that bind to proteins on the surface of leukemia cells, and the biology of the leukemia cells is such that we know quite a bit about what proteins are present on the leukemia cells that are not present on many other cells within the body. And then by giving these monoclonal antibodies, either by themselves or in combination with chemotherapy, there have been improvements in patient outcome. Of course, the mainstay has been the use of the drug rituximab, which targets a protein called CD20. And this is something that has caught the attention of other pharmaceutical companies who want to develop similar antibodies that might target the same protein. And that was the basis for the development of another antibody called ofatumumab, which was approved just recently for patients who had failed prior chemoimmunotherapy regimens. And ofatumumab is another antibody that binds CD20. There's yet a third antibody that binds CD20. It binds to it in a slightly different fashion, and it's been genetically engineered to be particularly active in causing the death of leukemic cells, and that's called GA101. There's now a name for it called obinutuzumab, and this antibody is in early clinical trials, and it may be similar to rituximab, but with an attitude in terms of having a dramatic effect against the leukemic cells. That certainly is something that we are very excited about in early going with our clinical trials performed here and elsewhere. I think that there are other proteins on the surface of the leukemia cells that are being targeted, and so there's quite a few trials that target proteins that are unique to B cells, such as CD19, but also antibodies that target proteins such as CD37 or other proteins. And so we may have a variety of different antibodies to choose from, either combinations of antibodies or a combination of the antibody with some of these newer agents or even chemotherapy may be particularly bright. There's been an attempt to try and find proteins that are unique to the leukemia cell, because as it is, when you target proteins such as CD20, you actually target other cells in the body called B cells that are responsible for making your antibody. Now, that's generally very well tolerated, but if we had something that was even more specific, that would be a plus. And so now there's work on defining new proteins, developmental proteins that may not be expressed on even B cells that may be targeted by monoclonal antibodies. Now, another area that's attracted a lot of interest is the use of immune modulating agents. There's one drug that's in clinical trials called lenalidomide or Revlimid. This agent is derived from the drug thalidomide. Now, many have heard about thalidomide. That was the drug that was banned from the planet after a very terrible experience in the 50s and early 60s when it was given to patients who were actually not with any leukemia, but they were wanting to sleep better, and the drug was given to, unfortunately, women in their third trimester pregnancy. This drug caused terrible birth defects with loss of limbs, and it was sort of banned from the planet, but then there was research on why this drug does what it does, and it turns out to inhibit new blood vessel formation. And that has been the cause for the birth defects that the drugs can cause. Well, someone had the bright idea that if you can inhibit new blood vessel formation, that could be potentially a very useful thing for the treatment of tumors, which need new blood supply. And so it was then tested in patients with various cancers and found to have some activity. And the drug was modified to make it less sedating, and that's what the drug Revlimid is all about. It tends to have the properties of a modulation of the immune response. There's been much work on finding out that the leukemia cells, which are really responsible for turning off the immune responses in patients, can be changed by the exposure to the drug lenalidomide, and they can be much more active in trying to recruit T cells and other cells to form immune responses. The one potential improved effect with the lenalidomide might be improvement in one's own ability to mount immune responses. But there's also apparently a change in how these cells may interact with other cells within the lymph node, and that could cause the suppression of the growth of these cells. And so patients who can tolerate lenalidomide seem to be able to go on and have a suppression of the progression of their disease. And again, this is a pill form, and it could be very effective also in improving the immune function of patients, particularly if they've had prior therapy that's weakened their immune system along with their leukemia. Now, there's a very exciting work, too, that's being tried to develop active immune therapies through various vaccines. You know, we and others have used approaches such as gene therapy to try and get the patients to respond to their own leukemia cells. More recently, this has been done with hands-on, namely to engineer, like an antibody, a protein that could bind to a surface protein on the leukemia cell. And what they can do is generate a receptor for T cells, which can then be put into your own T cells. This receptor can then be expressed by your T cells and then use that receptor to go after the leukemia cells. This is called chimeric antigen receptor and our CAR therapy. And CAR therapy works as the follow, where you have your T cells removed by a process either having the blood drawn or apheresis, and then the cells are modified genetically so that they can recognize the leukemia cells and then be put back in the body. Now, still work is having to be done because in many cases the T cells may expand quite vigorously inside patients, and that could cause some side effects. So we still have to figure out ways to harness this, but also we need to figure out ways to make the right receptors. Currently, the work is being done to target proteins which are found not only on leukemia cells, but on all other B cells, and this could result in depletion of your own B cells and the inability then to make antibodies after such therapy. So I think as this therapy gets refined, we may be able to improve upon it, and we still think that there's a possibility of making vaccines. There's been a discovery of proteins which are uniquely expressed on leukemia that could serve as a basis for vaccine. And I actually long for the day when patients, maybe at diagnosis, could be vaccinated so that they can develop the appropriate immune response to keep down the leukemia and make what might be a progressive disease into one that could either be a chronic maintained disease or one that they can eradicate altogether. So I think that the future is very bright. There's a number of clinical trials that are ongoing to test these and other agents. I think the clinical trials need to be done because we need to test the activity of these agents and test the ideas, and also to look for unexpected side effects. I don't think there's any treatment out there that I know of that doesn't have side effects, and so one has to appreciate the side effects so that you can be able to determine the risk-benefit ratio of whether it's important to take this type of therapy. And I think it's important to emphasize the value of research. Research does improve our therapeutic options. I think it was Einstein that said that insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting a different outcome. Now, clearly, if we were only relegated to the use of chlorambucil and had various regimens for giving chlorambucil, I think we would soon run out of a therapeutic maneuverability on that, and patients become resistant or refractory and are maybe intolerant to these types of agents. And so we can then look forward to the day when we can replace drugs like chlorambucil with newer agents that target what we know about the biology of the disease so that we're much more specific in targeting the leukemia cells and then leave the other cells of the body free. And that might then minimize the side effects and improve what we call the therapeutic index so that we will improve the quality of life during treatment and certainly after treatment. I must say about the quality of life, I think that it's important to recognize that in some patients, the leukemia itself impairs the quality of life. It may suppress the bone marrow. It may suppress our immune function, resulting in repeated infections and what have you. And I think as we develop newer therapies that are targeted to specific lesions and have a high, what we call therapeutic index, will improve the quality of life, not only for patients during the course of treatment, but beyond. And certainly if we can work towards curing this disease, that would be the best of all outcomes. But thank you for this opportunity to go over this, and I look forward to hearing questions from the audience.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kipps, for a very informative and very very systematic presentation on all the new approaches and the importance of trials and just all of the promise for the future. And we do look forward to having questions addressed to you as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Max Mulcahy, and he's Associate Director of Programs, Lymphoma Research Foundation. And Mr. Mulcahy is going to address the free support programs offered by the Lymphoma Research Foundation. Mr. Mulcahy?
Thank you, Carolyn. Thank you, everyone, for calling into our CLL teleconference today. I want to thank Cancer Care for putting this call together, in particular Carolyn Mesner, who always does a wonderful job to coordinate these seminars. I also want to thank our speakers, Dr. Thomas Kipps and Dr. Susan O'Brien, for taking the time to put together their presentations and deliver them to all of us today. And, of course, I also want to thank our supporters, Gilead and Teva Oncology. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the largest organization devoted exclusively to lymphoma. Our mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease, and we accomplish this goal through our research program and the educational programs and patient services we provide. LRF has funded over $51 million in lymphoma research since the inception of the organization, and that includes $2.9 million in CLL translational research. Over 50,000 people access our programs and services each year. This means people are attending one of our live education meetings, one of our professional meetings, accessing our teleconference series, downloading webcasts and podcasts, or calling into our lymphoma helpline. So by calling into our lymphoma helpline, CLL patients can receive information about CLL. We also offer a clinical trials information service where you can find out how to enroll in a CLL clinical trial and where the closest trial is located to you. Through our helpline, we also have a lymphoma support network where we can match you with another CLL patient, where you can offer each other support about navigating your CLL diagnosis. And this helpline service is staffed by trained professionals, and it's available in any language. We also offer a financial assistance program that provides a $200 grant that is meant to alleviate some of the transportation costs for patients that are getting to and from treatment. We have a variety of publications and newsletters, including a CLL comprehensive disease guide, a CLL fact sheet, and a CLL-specific website, which is www.focusonCLL.org. And we also have a CLL-specific e-news. And all of these resources offer the most up-to-date information about CLL and treatment options. And we also offer a variety of webcasts and podcasts from the CLL sessions of our live meetings. And these are all available on a podcast section of our website. We also host a series of live educational meetings, and we have five regional workshops, each of them with a CLL disease-specific session where patients learn the basic biology of CLL as well as the current treatment options and novel therapies that are currently in development. And finally, we host the North American Educational Forum on Lymphoma, and we do this every year. And this is a national meeting that spans 2.5 days. It features speakers, a speaking faculty from all the major academic centers from across the United States. And much like at the workshop, we also offer CLL disease-specific sessions, as well as sessions that provide patient and caregiver support. So for more information, please contact a member of our helpline team by calling 800-500-9976 or writing to helpline@lymphoma.org, or you can also visit our website, which is www.lymphoma.org. And LRF is committed to helping and aiding patients with CLL, so I highly encourage you to utilize all these valuable resources. Thank you very much. Thanks, Carolyn.
Well, thank you very much, Max, and it's a pleasure working with the Lymphoma Research Foundation. We've been working together for now for over 15 years on any programs that are lymphoma-related teleconferences, and it's just a pleasure to work with you and with Brian Tomlinson as well. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Erin Columbus. Ms. Columbus is an oncology social worker. She's Program Director of Online Client Services at Cancer Care. And she will address the free support services offered by Cancer Care as well as support groups as well. Ms. Columbus?
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this call today. As an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, I'd like to just take a few minutes to talk about the emotional and social impact of cancer and how Cancer Care can help you. When you're first diagnosed with cancer, it certainly can be an extremely overwhelming experience. You're faced with a series of choices that will have a major impact on your life, and you may not know where to turn. Talking to a Cancer Care social worker here can help you to maximize that support that you get from your healthcare team, especially in dealing with issues such as symptom management, finding out more about your treatment options, and basically learning how to navigate the system to get the best care possible. Cancer Care is a staff of licensed oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We're experienced in how a cancer diagnosis affects a person and their family and friends, and we're also trained to help patients and their loved ones manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise. One of the most important things, I think, to acknowledge about the emotional impact of cancer is that it can be felt as a loss. It can be a loss that manifests itself in many ways, from the loss of your independence, loss of energy levels, and in the big picture, the loss of the life that you had before cancer. Specifically for people living with blood cancers, there are often many complex emotions that may accompany the diagnosis, due to the far-reaching and chronic nature of the disease and its treatment and side effects. These physical and emotional changes can often feel very difficult to manage. Additionally, it's caregivers who are often especially in need of counseling and support, largely because watching a loved one change in these ways can be very painful. That's why it's important to have an outlet to acknowledge these losses and to have someone you can talk to who will be supportive and empathic. This can mean talking one-on-one with a Cancer Care social worker, or it can also happen in one of our support groups. Cancer Care does offer face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, and we also offer telephone and online support groups. These groups offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Participating in a group can be helpful simply by allowing you to talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else really can. And group members also offer encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with additional support, guidance, and practical advice. In fact, I wanted to mention we're currently offering an online group for people with blood cancers. This is a safe and confidential space where you might find commonality with others. If you are interested in participating in this online group, please visit our website at www.cancercare.org for more information and instructions on how to register for this particular group. Lastly, cancer can have a significant impact, as you all know, on your finances. And for many of the people I talk to every day, this can be an overwhelming aspect of cancer. Cancer Care does provide limited financial assistance to help with things like transportation or help with home care, child care, or pain medication. We can also connect you with other organizations for additional help to help you with those costs of cancers. While we may not be able to resolve all of the problems you're facing right now, a Cancer Care social worker certainly provides a listening ear and the ability to walk alongside you as you navigate this difficult experience. Many patients and caregivers find this to be a reassuring and comforting service that can help you to feel that you're not alone. So please feel free to contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our supportive services. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you very much, Erin, for really very, very succinctly and eloquently describing the services of cancer care. And now we do have time for questions, and we have lots of time for questions from our audience. And I'm going to ask Sam to bring all of our speakers on board and actually to let the audience know how to queue up and ask questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. Sam?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question at this time, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Our first question comes from Robert V. Your line is now open.
Hello. Could you expand a little bit more on the clinical trial you mentioned that was being conducted with Cal-101?
Sure. Thank you, Robert, for that question. Dr. Kipps, yes.
Well, currently the Cal-101 is called GS-1101 because the Calistoga, which was the company developing the Cal-101, was taken over by the Gilead company, and so now it's called GS-1101. Currently the drug is going through what's called registration trials. Namely, the patients are given the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial, and they are then, once they are screened and found eligible for the trial, they will be sometimes what we call randomized, where they are given one treatment arm versus another treatment arm. This is sometimes given to patients in combination with other agents. For example, one clinical trial where the combination of bendamustine and rituximab, which is commonly used for treating patients with CLL, it's found that the combination may be coupled with the GS-1101 without increasing its apparent toxicity. And so the idea of maybe the three agents together might successfully induce complete remissions in patients with CLL. However, this is not noted to be the case, and so patients are going to then receive either the GS-1101 with bendamustine rituximab or alternatively receive what might be considered a placebo. It may seem that this is kind of senseless to get one agent versus the placebo, and I think it's because we, at this point, still do not know what the outcome of those studies will be, and the FDA in particular is very interested in comparing what might be considered a good treatment regimen, such as bendamustine rituximab, and then see how this drug with the GS-1101 combined with it might improve the outcome. And since the patients are randomized, the two groups can be compared. And so any improvement in responses and how well patients do is something that will be directly comparable. The FDA puts a lot of stake into those trials because it's fairly easy to see a difference if there is one. And then they can assuredly make a call as to whether the GS-1101 has added value over what is currently being done. I think the FDA has sometimes concern about approving agents before they have declared themselves to have added value, and that's for obvious reasons, so that the drugs are not being promoted without being truly having an extra value for patients. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Kipps. We have a question from one of our online participants, and that is CLL hereditary? Dr. O'Brien, could you address that?
Not in the classic sense that we think of a disease being passed down like blue eyes or brown eyes, no. But we do notice that there are a small percentage of people with CLL where it does seem to run in the family. And it's not as clear-cut as if a father or mother has it, a child has it. Sometimes it skips a generation, so maybe a grandparent has it or an aunt or an uncle. And there is a fair bit of research going on trying to define, you know, what is happening in families where there is, I would say, more of a tendency, since not everybody in the family will get it, to develop CLL. However, as I said, those patients where they have a family history represent only a small percentage of patients who get diagnosed with CLL. And right now, the only thing that we know that has been associated with the development of CLL in terms of exposures is Agent Orange. And so the Army does consider Agent Orange people who develop CLL who have been in the Army and exposed to it as having a disease related to their service. But there's really, truthfully, very little known about what predisposes people to develop CLL.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Justin S. Your line is now open.
There is a Dr. John Sarno, MD, who specializes in back pain, and he says that people can look terrible on their x-rays and should have back pain but don't feel anything abnormal. And people that show clean x-rays complain of severe back pain. He says that if he tells them it's psychosomatic, they get offended. So he calls them to examine their mind-body connection.
And did you have a question that you wanted to ask?
Here it is. Do you have any hints about cleaning up our emotions to clear up our leukemia? Because I do have leukemia, so I'm interested.
Dr. O'Brien, do you want to address that?
Well, you know, no, there's no clear relationship between emotional patterns or and what happens in CLL. I will say that it's not uncommon to see patients' lymphocyte counts kind of bounce around, mm-hmm. which is why we always tell patients, you know, we would never treat based on one day's worth of blood counts. You have to look at the trend over time. And what is responsible for that bouncing around is sometimes not clear. But I can't say that there is a very strong correlation between emotions and progression or lack of progression of the disease. People often ask, well, what can I do in terms of what if I change my diet, what if I do this? And what I always tell them is the bad news and the good news are the same in a way. The bad news is there's not a lot you can do. The good news is you don't have to dramatically change your lifestyle. What I will say is important, though, this is true for anyone, but particularly important for patients with CLL, is maintaining a healthy lifestyle and doing all of the normal things that one would do in terms of surveillance for other cancers. Because it is true that patients with CLL have a slightly higher incidence of second cancers than patients who don't. So, you know, what you don't want to do is have the attitude that, well, I have leukemia, so what would it matter if I had colon cancer or breast cancer or whatever? Because, as I said early on, people with CLL in many cases can live many, many, many years, and they can die of other things. And so mammography is at the appropriate time, colon cancer screening, et cetera, are important in everybody, but they're particularly important in patients with CLL.
Awesome. Thank you. And our next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Arlene L. Your line is now open.
Yes, thank you. Is there a way to find out a prognosis after chemotherapy is started, or is every case individual?
Dr. O'Brien, could you address that? And I'm going to ask Dr. O'Brien to address that in a general way, and then we hope you'll take this information back to your treating healthcare team. Dr. O'Brien?
Yes and no. I mean, we like to look at the prognostic factors before treatment or at the time of diagnosis. Now, can we look at them anytime? Yes, and some of them actually change. So, for example, one thing that definitely changes with time are chromosome abnormalities, where chromosome abnormalities that are kind of higher risk are often associated with people who've had disease for a longer period of time or have been have had a lot of prior treatment. So there are some of the factors that even if we got them at diagnosis, we would want to repeat later. And there's some that don't change at all. So even if you've had disease for 3 years, you can look at the prognostic factors. Now, it depends what you're using them for. So in other words, I mentioned early on that one of the things we look at is to try and give a patient with a newly diagnosed CLL a feel for, you know, are you going to be in the group that might go 10-plus years without treatment? Or are you in the group that, yeah, you don't need any treatment now, but it's more likely to be 2 years, not 10-plus years? Well, the point is that if you've already had your disease for 6 years, Yeah, and you haven't needed treatment. You can look at the prognostic factors, but why do you need them so much at that point? In other words, your disease has already declared itself as very slow-moving, and at that exact point in time, there may not be a lot of reason to get these factors. We do recommend looking at the time treatment's going to be initiated because some of the chromosome abnormalities are associated with a less good response to chemo, such as the 17p deletion, and some of the trials that Dr. Kipps mentioned might be preferable to people who are predicted not to respond that well to chemotherapy. And so there, knowing, for example, the chromosome analysis could actually make a difference on the choice of therapy. So there are some times when one might want to look at it, but if you've had disease for 6 years and you're doing fine, is there any real reason to check them at that point in time? Not really.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, our next question, please. These are wonderful questions.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jeffrey G. Your line is now open.
Yes, I'm a CLL patient who is severely immune compromised, and I have no other symptoms besides that. But it means that I now get monthly infusions of immunoglobulins, and I'm particularly interested in what Dr. Kipps had to say about promising treatments that may be in the works for immune deficient symptoms. This my disease does not require treatment itself, but the symptoms are severe. Is there anything in the works at all besides immunoglobulin?
Thank you for that question. And Dr. Kipps, could you address that?
Yes, I think that's a very important question because immune deficiency is one of the major problems that patients with CLL have. And so if you think about it, a lot of our therapy is directed against CLL cells, and so with treatment, we can actually make sometimes the immune deficiency worse because we may attack other cells of the immune system. I think the strategy of using potentially like immune modulating agents, and I mentioned one, lenalidomide or Revlimid, is one that has been shown to change how the leukemia cell actually interacts with other immune cells in the body. And in work that's been done in the laboratory, you could see when these cells are exposed to Revlimid, they actually can engage T cells because prior to the treatment, the leukemia cells may put T cells to sleep. They may slow down the immune system. And the drug seems to affect the reversal of how these cells may do this to actually improve how they can waken T cells up to be able to mount an immune response. This is similar to other strategies that we and others have employed to try and find proteins that might trigger this change in the leukemia cell to make them more immunogenic. That could be done perhaps through gene transfer. But I think that these strategies, particularly for patients who have very severe immune deficiencies, can be a plus. We've had some patients, for example, who after treatment they've had very profound immune deficiencies such that even with IVIG, have not been able to be free of infections. And with the use of either Revlimid or, in some cases, a gene therapy vaccine approach, we've seen their antibody levels rise, as well as their resistance to infections, both common infections and more esoteric ones that ordinarily don't affect you unless you have a weakened immune system. So I think that if you're not having treatment that's necessary for other reasons, and there is this profound immune deficiency, then potentially getting into consider such agents would be a worthwhile thing to do. I would recommend doing it for somebody who's very familiar with the use of these agents. As I mentioned, no treatment is without side effects, and so you'd want to be able to keep on top of whatever side effects may be there, and there are certain steps that can be done to mitigate those side effects. In particular, for example, the drug Revlimid may actually be associated with a higher incidence of blood clots, and we found that that can be mitigated by the use of low-dose aspirin in patients. But again, it's important to go to an area where you have physicians who are experienced with these newer modalities to try and resurrect the immune system, and that could be very helpful. I think the ultimate thing is to try and develop vaccines prior to the development of this immune deficiency. That's something that's worth ongoing and could be quite exciting if we can mount an immune response to go after the leukemia cells prior to the time when our immune system is already having problems. So I think that this is the thing that we're very hopeful that we can certainly see in the future.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Stuart J. Your line is now open.
Thank you. Let me just thank all the participants and let you know, even after 13 years as a CLL survivor, I'm still learning things. So thank you for the information. Just to let you know, I've been through a whole series, FCR, 2 years of Rituxan, a Hyper CVAD. I was an early recipient of the Cal 101, followed by bendamustine.
Do you have a question that you wanted to ask our speakers? Or?
Yes, and the 17 months post-transplant. My question regards GVHD. I'm still vertical, but I'm having some serious difficulties with graft versus host disease in various areas of my body. I wanted to know what progress is being made towards the survivor end of the whole process.
Stuart, that's an excellent question. Thank you so much for asking it. Dr. O'Brien, could you address that in a general way?
Yes, I mean, just like there's a lot of research that goes on in all cancer types, in CLL in particular, stem cell transplanters are also doing trials testing innovative drugs to treat GVH. As a patient alluded to, one of the long-term complications of transplant, which can really be problematic in terms of the side effects that the patient experiences, is chronic graft versus host disease. And for people who don't really know what we're talking about, when you have a stem cell transplant, unless you have a transplant from an identical twin, even when we say that the donor's a match, it's never really a perfect match because only an identical twin would be a perfect match. So there are always some discrepancies between the donated cells and the recipient or the patient. What can sometimes happen is that those donated cells, in other words, the graft, can start to see the recipient, the patient, as foreign. Because it's not a perfect match and can start actually attacking the organs. Very mild GVH typically involves the skin and presents as a skin rash, and then there can be more serious involvement, including the GI tract and the liver, and people can sometimes be seriously ill. So that's probably the most common and serious long-term complication of a stem cell transplant, as was mentioned, and I think there are some drugs that are in clinical trials to try and deal with this complication, which is often problematic.
Excellent. Thank you. And I want to thank our speakers today. You've been extraordinary, and I want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked such really incredible questions. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I want to remind all of you that if you have any questions that you didn't get to ask, that you certainly can go ahead and call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, or you can call the Lymphoma Research Foundation at 1-800-500-9976. Most importantly, in planning our program, we do not want anyone to leave this program feeling like you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're here to help you. And we are simply a telephone call away, or you can visit our respective websites as well. Again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect. Everyone, have a wonderful day.